For those of you who didn't know me before today, you'll need to know that the folks heckling have known me for quite several years. So there's a whole crowd over here that I've pastored alongside of before. For my life, I was a student here. I was called to preach when I was only 11 years old, saved when I was 8, called to preach when I was 11. And so from that point on, my life has been either pointed toward becoming a minister or being a minister. Pastored in upstate New York for 6 years, came over to Newcomerstown on the East Ohio District for almost 9. Was down in Central Ohio for 3, back up to Akron First, which is now called Fish Creek, for 5 years. Answered the phone one day, and it was the general treasurer on the line. And she said, "We would like a resume from you." And that started a major life shift that I would have never guessed. I've almost been at headquarters longer than I was at any church. But that was an interesting process because they were talking to me and said, this is what has to happen. The church has a general board, like a local church has a board, and the board has to elect you, but they won't elect you unless all 6 general superintendents recommend your name to them. And I said, I don't think there's any general superintendent that would recognize my name. And they said, "Yes, you're right. We've asked them. They don't know who you are." That's how I got to headquarters. But along the way, 5 daughters, a wonderful wife that I met here, doctorate from master's from Master of Divinity from seminary, doctor of ministry from Fuller Theological Seminary. And all along the way, since I've been 18 years old, I've been an Ohio licensed auctioneer. So every once in a while, I stand in front of people and do fun things like, "Hey, bit of a 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 bit of a." It's been a long time since you guys heard that, hasn't it? All right, but I have a session today on understanding generational giving trends that is probably the most popular one I've done over the last year, where we're answering the question, what's going through the mind of the different age brackets, the millennials or the baby boomers and so forth? What's going on when they are presented with an appeal? What causes them to be motivated to say, "I would like to take some of my money and give it to this cause"? And the motivations are fairly different for those things. So that's what we're here for. If you were looking for something else, then it's next door, I guess. I don't know. And I won't be offended by questions. In fact, I welcome them all the way through. You won't throw me off timing or anything if you ask a question right when you have the question, when we're in it. Otherwise, we'll have to reestablish the context, and we'll both get confused along the way. I didn't bring anything to pass out to you, but all of the notes, there are note-taking sheets at the little bit.ly thing you have up here. So from your phone or whatever, you can go to bit.ly/ SOS Handouts. That stands for School of Stewardship Handouts. And that's what, if you go there, you will have access to not only that, but the PowerPoints for all of the presentations that I have. And you're welcome to use them anywhere in life. If you make a lot of money, share some with me. That would be generous. I try to share stuff with people that I steal from. So, all right. So we're in this realm of philanthropy. Most pastors don't consider themselves to be philanthropy or fundraisers involved in philanthropy. But philanthropy is a real word that has really surfaced in our culture. It's a popular thing. Lots of books on giving. Bill Clinton wrote a book on giving. And a lot of attention around Bill Gates and all the people that have given tons and tons of money away. Who knows what the word philanthropy actually comes from? Go back to Greek class. Brotherly is the philos, yes. And anthropos? The love of man. So it's actually the love of mankind. Loving mankind is really good. It's only second to loving God and part of the greatest commandments that we've been giving. However, it is possible to love mankind and not love God. So philanthropy on its own is incomplete. So while we as Christians are very likely to participate in philanthropy, which is giving our money for a humanitarian purpose to help humanity because we love humanity, that's not our only motivation, and it's really incomplete for what we are. What's a better word to describe what we're like with our money as Christians? Stewards, yes. You read that off my shirt, didn't you? Stewardship, absolutely. And stewardship is a word that actually comes from a service-oriented, the under-rowers, the workers, and then in the New Testament it comes into the caring for the owner's objects. So stewarding something is to take care of something that somebody else has. You've been given a responsibility to care for this item or that item and take good care of it and help it to grow and care for it. But stewardship is a word that the world is currently hijacking. So if you took your Google search app out and you searched stewardship, what would you expect to find on major corporations in America, many of whom have stewardship pages these days? It's all about environmental stewardship. So you go to major corporations and you see the word stewardship up there, and they're telling you, we've got our smokestacks scrubbed. Scrubbed so much that nothing toxic is coming out of it. And when we dump our water into the Ohio River, the water going to the Ohio River is just the right temperature, doesn't kill any frogs. And so that's good. We certainly believe in that. In fact, the Lord told us to do that all the way back in Genesis. He said, care for the earth. He didn't say worship it. He said not to worship it, not to worship the animals, but to care for them and have dominion over them. But we are, as caretakers of those things, involved in stewardship. But Christians use the term stewardship to mean far more than just environmental stewardship, but to care for the things that God has given us. And since it looks like most of us in the room are alive, He's given us some time. He's given us some time today. Hopefully we're good stewards of that and using that time well. Since most of you look like you've had something to eat today, He must have given us some money. You know, we have some resources. And so these resources that God allows us to have, we as stewards are caretakers of those things. Yet it's a diversified world we live in. And we have some generational distinctions. Now, my purpose is not to teach you what the distinctions are in these things, but I do want to reference them just a little bit. But since you're all from Ohio and bright, oh, wait a minute, we have one from Pennsylvania, don't we? Even brighter from Pennsylvania, you tell me, what are some of the characteristics of the war generation? Who are they?
Savers.
Yes, they were really good at saving. When were they born? Yeah. Yeah, 45, 1945 or earlier. We're running out of them. There's not as many of them as there used to be. They're 5% of America's workforce. These folks had some real characteristics. These are, think of Bob Dole. Bob and Elizabeth Dole, for that matter. They were those kind of people. Strong veterans, often. Believed in moral authority. It's right because it's right, and it's wrong because it's wrong. Don't ask any questions, because that's the way it is. That's actually great for preaching. They remember things like many of them would remember the Great Depression. And that had a real deep effect on them, because they lived through times that most of us have never seen. We might have, it's rare, but we might have lived in our lives in a day where we couldn't run down to the grocery store and get something to eat. But most of us have never lived in the day when you went down to the grocery store and there was nothing to buy to eat, when there just weren't resources. When we were so conservative, we were saving bacon grease to make bombs in World War II and all the different things that they lived through. And that affected them. Their work careers, they liked to, would typically work to save for retirement. And so the life plan was 30 or 40 years, you put it into a company, and you save and you work and you retire off that money. The next group coming down there are the baby boomers, and what are they like? I'm on the young end of that group. We like to spend money. We have an advanced society or our family wealth as much as the generation that came before us, but it's also a very wealthy group though. Spend a lot, but a very wealthy group. These people, the baby boomers, probably most of us in here, are the wealthiest group that has ever existed in any society. And we're all getting ready to go to heaven or someplace. And when we do, all those assets are going someplace. But we are the wealthiest batch of people that have ever existed in the history of mankind. And we like to use it. Not only do we spend it, we like to spend it on ourselves. Very oriented toward taking care of ourselves, the me generation. A lot heavily influenced by the Vietnam War and some of the revolutions and thought process that went through all of that sort of thing. And we've worked hard, we've saved hard, but we've done that in order to retire. We want to retire, but we've had a little easier life. So we have started to have some expectations that Social Security is going to be there, and that a pension fund should not be evacuated. That somebody else has got to be involved in the process of preparing for a retirement. The war generation had their savings. That's the way they looked at it. We look at it as pension funds and 401ks and somebody else out there with Social Security or whatever. Generation X is a little harder to define. In general, born from 65 to 1990. And so whereas Bill Clinton is the baby boomer, Barack Obama would be the old end of the Generation X kind of a person, and certainly thinking like that, affected by things like Watergate, energy crisis, tragedies, things that that cause them to do a lot of questioning of what's right and what's wrong in society, and not as patriotic in many cases, not as sold on America being great again, maybe even. And then the millennials, what are the younger group? And there's lots of subgroups, lots of folks have multiple divisions in these things, and the next group's coming along. I'm using rather broad categories here, but tell me just a little bit about the millennials. Yeah, they do consume, that's for sure.
More technological.
Yeah.
Technology.
Yeah, they grew up with buttons in their hands. Yeah. They're fun to put in front of a rotary telephone. They don't know what to do with it. Try to poke in the holes and nothing happens. We have a bunch of them work at headquarters, and I briefly referenced Chris Christopherson one day, and they said, "Who's Chris Christopherson?" I said, "I can't possibly move forward in life working with people that don't know who Chris Christopherson is," but we got through that. But it only got worse when one of the young accountants, when I said, I was driving through Cincinnati, right down Pete Rose Way, and said, "Who's Pete Rose?" We work with the people at headquarters that don't know who Pete Rose is. and life is most definitely different. But from a work standpoint, expectations are quite a bit different because, you know, the older crowd there, they said, "Give me a job, I'll go do that job." And our generation, even the baby boomers, we worked because it benefited the corporation. So you go in, and if you do training, if your boss says, "We would like to put you through some training," the idea is, oh, the company has a need. It's all about the company. I must go through the training. I must work overtime because it's all about the company. And all that's changed when you come down to managing the younger folks, and the job is just totally different. They're not even, from the Generation X on down, they're not even impressed with money. I have young people in their 20s, single, with nothing but their job, and I offer them overtime on the weekend, and some of them have $60,000 or more in educational debt. I offer them overtime on the weekend, and they're, "No, I don't think so." I need this done, and that doesn't seem to be a motivator, but you should be motivated by a little extra money because you really need the money. "Well, I just like to keep a real balance between my work life and my home life," which our generation, the baby boomers, we had, there was no balance whatsoever. You know, the war generation is home and work, they are two separate lives. We keep those separate. We sacrificed a lot as baby boomers, and we'd sacrifice in order to help the company and so forth. And there's no company mentality with the younger folks. They're coming into the world with a totally different perspective than all that, because it's really about them. So if you want me to do training, that's because I need to work more. And if you pay for their training, and they come down to the end of the training and somebody else offers them more money and they go there to work, they have no sense of loyalty to the fact that, hey, this group paid for me to work, I should stay here and work for them for a while. Because it's really seen as the whole work situation is about me, and they're far more motivated and impressed by time off or flexible time, a flexible work schedule, having the ability to go to yoga class if they want to go to yoga class or whatever, than they are with the money or any of the things that would traditionally motivate us. So there's a lot of characteristics on these things, but we don't see a lot of characteristics of the actual funding of what they do with their money and how they do this how they handle their finances. So rather than go through four, I'm going to say people like me, and that's me and older, and people not like me, which are younger than me. And I'm modern, which I used to think was a compliment until I used the word in front of some of them. And they explained to me, oh, yes, you are modern. What did they mean by that? Yeah. Yeah, that modern is no longer, you know, to me, modern just means this is has to do with today. But modern now means a period of time that is now over. And they do associate me with the modern period. It's back there. I hate it when people change all the words, can never keep up with it all. I'm used to traditional media. Much of what I've learned came out of a paper book or a magazine, so forth. Although I have adapted to internet life and so forth, that's secondary for me. The groups coming behind us are postmodern, and they're quite socially different. They're not used to the traditional media in the same way. I actually have a parent of five daughters. Our five daughters are 18 to 28, so they're all millennials. And most of my illustrations are coming from them. But the 21-year-old, who's a sophomore in college and a good student, decided she wanted to mail one of her friends from school a card. And 2 days later, asked me why it came back to our mailbox. Well, she did put a stamp on it. But I said, well, Mariah, let's look at this. Where did you put your address? Right in the middle. So here's a 21-year-old that didn't know that her address was supposed to go up on the left. She had the return address and the where it's going address entirely mixed up, and I couldn't see why it came back. So this is just the way the life is. So we understood words like chalkboard and pencil, and they've got these words change all the time. Nobody uses a magic mouse anymore. Everything is the social media, the language, the terminology changes so fast you can't keep up with it out there. They all moved away from Facebook because we moved in, right? So now what are they doing? Instagram, Snapchat, what else? Twitter? Yeah. Yeah. What's really fun is when I do this presentation, I have a group of millennials in here, because one of the things they can't stand is being talked about or categorized. So I changed it just a little bit for them, but yeah. Periscope is one of them, the live media video stuff coming along. They invent things and use them and get rid of them faster than we can catch up with what the language is. But folks like us, for the most part, we take pride in our theological rigidity. I think when I was 15, I could have told you the difference between the Baptist church and the Nazarene church in town. I could have told you that one believed in once saved, always saved, and we didn't. And we believed that there's two works of grace. You get saved, and then after you get saved, you need to have an experience with the Holy Spirit. And that was pretty important, those theological distinctions right there. And the world coming up behind us is a lot more Christian generic. I may even say evangelical generic. Unless they've been to seminary, because there's no flexible. If you go to seminary, if you go to college and you study it, they do very, very well. And they actually make great theologians. But the general populace just kind of has a cloud of knowledge called Christianity, and the different brands of Christianity they float from one to the other pretty fluidly. I respect tradition, but I don't get liturgy. Okay, so I'm really happy. In fact, I could go to heaven if my worship consisted for the remainder of my life with a hymnal, two hymns, a bad pianist, and one person leading the singing. I could get to heaven that way, and it really wouldn't feel that bad to me or that wrong to me, because I've done a lot of that in my life. It's pretty traditional in any of the words. But I don't get liturgy. And the world is changing around us. Even our own Nazarene folks repel tradition because it's traditional, but somehow have gone back a step farther than that to liturgy and are very attracted to liturgy. So we have in Kansas City young churches full of millennials, just full of millennials that meet in old stone Presbyterian-looking facilities, have communion as the center of worship, and do a very liturgical worship service. That just doesn't make sense to me, but that's the way the world is turning as it's going along. And the world that I grew up in understood holiness as purity, and we had very rigid ways of defining that. Let me tell you, God's Bible College out of Cincinnati sent all the preachers out to where I grew up, and They all wore a white shirt, and they all wore buns in their hair and long sleeves and so forth. And we were pretty much taught that way. Before I got out of seminary, one of the tasks we had to do was to preach in front of a video camera and then watch it with Wes Tracy. Anybody remember Wes Tracy? And so he's sitting there about halfway through my sermon, and he looks closer at the screen. He says, "Is that a yellow shirt you're wearing or a white shirt?" I said, "That's a white shirt, sir." He said, "Good. I think when a young man stands in a pulpit, he ought to have a white shirt on, don't you?" I said, "Yes, sir, I do." And I wore it, didn't I? I wore white shirts a lot longer than most of the rest of you all did. But we had our understanding. The millennial generation understands holiness as love. Let me tell you, there are some major improvements right here. Because they absorb the concept of loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. And that behavior as loving is the measure, not the externals that we tended to focus on for a couple generations out there. So they're moving in the right direction. We're stepping out of leadership, and these folks are stepping in. And folks like us give generously. How many of you, if you were going to lose a decade of people in your congregation, would rather lose your 20-somethings or your 50-somethings? From a financial perspective. Yeah, the 50-something is pretty important to us, right? There's really nobody that knows if... because when we were young, we might have said the same thing. We didn't want to do it. We really don't know, are the giving patterns more based on the age you are, or were there other factors with us? For example, are the 20-somethings going to have the earning potential and the giving potential that the 50- and 60-year-olds do now? Are they going to carry that weight, or will they not? We do know some things. They have not grown up in a world atmosphere of Bible learning, Sunday school teaching, and the concept of tithe being preached and taught on a very regular basis. Many of them haven't. Obviously, that's not true of every church. But I think you could have marched up and down the road 40 years ago, stuck a microphone in somebody's mouth and said, "What's a tithe?" And folks could explain that to you. But that's a less common theme for them out there. It's actually a very common theme with God, because he talked about it. And I think it's still God's plan. But our generation has given generously, still gives generously, and a lot of how churches and nonprofits are working in the world are from our generation. The generation coming behind us also gives very generously. In fact, there's some data that would indicate that the millennial generation, which is the next big swell of population, when you talk about the war generation, there wasn't nearly many of them. There's this big swell of people that were the millennials, or the baby boomers. Then there are smaller generations. The millennials are the next big hump coming along. In fact, in just a few years, they're going to be 75% of the workforce. While we're on Social Security, 75% will be millennials. That's going to really change the atmosphere that's out there. But there is evidence that the millennials could possibly be the most generous generation that the world has ever seen, that will give away more of their stuff, give away more of their income, give away more of their things. And that's clearly evidenced from your churches, right? It's not evidenced? Yeah. Yeah, they are very particular about their giving. Not necessarily motivated by guilt. You could scare me into tithing pretty easy. You know, one sermon on God said do this. If you don't do what God says, you go to hell, so give 10% of your income. That I've probably heard that kind of preaching enough in my life that has an effect and does that sort of thing. Not a great motivator for the folks coming along behind us. But we give differently than they give. We like to give institutionally. So we go through this at headquarters when we say, hey, we need to tell people about the World Evangelism Fund. The World Evangelism Fund, that's good. Let's go get some money for the World Evangelism Fund. Well, let's tell everybody. We have over 700 missionaries in 159 world areas. And this is a $38 million fund that you ought to give to. What's that do for you? Burden. Pardon me? It puts a burden. It puts a burden on you? It's not a burden. It's a wonderful thing. This is great. 700 missionaries. And for those of us who are baby boomers, who like General Motors, who haven't been as affected by Enron and all the different kind of things out there, and we tend to trust bigger things, we like bigger stuff. The bigger, the better. We trust it. Institutional. Our experience with government is different. That's a motivating thing for us. And it's interesting because those statements that tell how big this fund is and how big the world is and how big our operation is are exactly the turnoff statements for the millennial generation coming along behind us. Because they don't trust General Motors. They don't like big things. And that is actually very repulsive to them, that how could anything that's $38 million big in 159 countries possibly be any good? It's way too good to be that. They like to give discretionally. They want to know the people they're giving to. American Bible Society, which is a big, old, clunky organization kind of like us. Not the American Bible Society, the American Red Cross. American Red Cross, big, old, clunky organization like a denomination, is trying to invent ways that millennials, who like to invent things, like to invent their own processes, can invent something and make it happen under the umbrella of the American Red Cross, because they recognize that they're not going to fit the organization the way the organization is. An example of how they would think is this. Let's say God put on your heart right now, Bibles. You've got to put Bibles in people's hands. People need Bibles. Will you do something? What would you do if God put that message on your heart? Pardon me? Who would you give to? American Bible Society, Gideon's. Many of us would go through, International Bible Society, American Bible Society. I will give to them because that will put Bibles in people's hands. And the millennials, by the time we think of that, will have started a GoFundMe page, collected money from their friends for Bibles, and be walking down the street passing them out, because they see that little hands-on operation as something different. They come out of seminary the same way. We're graduating seminary graduates that don't want a Nazarene church. They want a place, a small place, where they can live their life and minister to the people in a small community atmosphere. They want to do that, but sticking them in a church somewhere with, you know, electric bills and stuff like that is just totally off their radar, not something that they are interested in doing. We're talking about generalities. Of course, there's obviously differences. But when we collect the World Evangelism Fund, we have been motivated to give distant and far. And this showed up in our missionary services, because we used to have a missionary come in. A missionary would come in and show us some pictures. When I was growing up, you didn't have colors and pictures, and you get to see snakes in far away places, because we only had a black and white 12-inch television, and we only had 3.5 radio stations. If you counted WXIX in Cincinnati, you had four. You know, you could, if you had the UHF station that would come in. So we didn't get to see things or to do all this stuff. So the missionary would come in, tell their story, show their pictures, touch their trinkets and so forth, and they would say, I'm doing a great ministry. In order for me to do my great ministry, you need to give money. My parents would write a check out or drop money in the offering plate and give it to them. The farther away that missionary was, the holier it seemed. We like to give away distant. We like to, rather than local, we like for that money to go someplace else, and that missionary would pack up and go away, and my parents would never hear from that missionary again. But they trusted because it was Nazarene, because it had a name of an organization that they liked, that they trusted. They knew everything was okay. They had no expectations for any feedback from that missionary whatsoever. We're now living in a world where there's very relatively few unexplored places. And if you want to know something about anywhere, you can see it from Google Maps. You can look at it. You can taste it. You can do almost everything to connect with almost any part of the world. And so sending a missionary in and saying, this missionary is going to be here and gone tomorrow, they don't want to give to that. They want to have relationship. It's about relationship with them. They have a relationship with the missionary, would like to go see the missionary, would like to bring the missionary's kids to their home. They would like to support it for the long run and have a involvement in their life, because they connect their volunteerism to their giving more than we ever did. And so they're motivated by need and connectivity. And while we baby boomers feel complete after giving, we give the money away and say, whew, that felt good, it's done now, they want to stay involved in the cause, and they want to have lots and lots of feedback. Their requirement for follow-up and feedback is far more significant than anything we've had. And so, whereas people like me write a check, put it in an envelope, and get a stamp, etc., these folks come along and they can't remember whether they have checks or not. Literally, my 24-year-old, I said, Lydia, she had to have a check for some reason. I said, write a check. She said, I don't have any checks. said, do you have a checking account? She said, I always wondered why they called it that. She said, I don't think they ever gave me any checks. Had never written a check in her life. And this is important because of our giving patterns. How many of you have a way for people to go online and give? Yeah, so Beaver Creek does and Pennsylvania does. If I come back in 10 years, everybody's going to raise their hands. So it's going to happen. The world is moving that direction. And interestingly, the segment of population that is increasing their online donation faster than any other segment is the 65-year-olds and above. Because they have learned to pay their bills this way and found out this isn't so awful bad. And they can adjust to change. We adjust to change that makes their life easier pretty well. With my grandmother back in the 70s, we got her a microwave and she was furious. She did not understand a microwave. She wanted us to take it back. She didn't like this thing. Couldn't stand it. She also liked her coffee really, really hot. And so when we showed her how to heat her coffee up, she adjusted to microwaves really easy. I mean, it was a nice transition once she found out what this thing could do for her. And so the older generations now are learning that this is actually safer. An online transaction today is safer than a check, even at headquarters. The account numbers and everything, they get locked down, secure, moved off. If you mail a check in, all kind of people have their eyes on it and can see it. And a check has everything you need. It has your routing number, your bank account number, your address, probably your phone number, and how you spell your name and all kind of things. And so you're handing that to every person you write a check to. The world is becoming more comfortable with, but it is definitely safer to do an online transaction than it is to do a paper transaction these days. And so we need to provide a way for that to happen for our congregations. And when we talk about, sometimes I do a whole session just on online giving, how this happens. It's less expensive than it ever used to be. There's a company down here that just rebuilt the Funding the Mission website. They move all of your dollars on Funding the Mission to headquarters. So they're moving $1.5 million a month for the headquarters. They will move money from your people to your bank account for $15 a month and a quarter a transaction if you don't turn credit cards off on. And I would turn credit cards off for tithe. I don't want to pay 3% or more for tithe. I don't think that's necessary. So I would only go with a company that lets you turn off credit cards for giving. However, if I was registering people for Upward Basketball or for selling them tickets to a banquet or something, I might turn credit cards on for that and just build the cost into the event, which would make sense. But this is very doable. You want a company that's going to be there in the long run. You want a company that understands churches, not a company that has built their system to handle payments for water departments everywhere and figured out, hey, we could market to churches too. You want somebody that understands churches. I do recommend these guys down here, Stewardship Technology. They're, if you're walking into the sanctuary of the chapel over there, the farthest one on the left, the farthest booth on the left. It's very affordable these days. You want the flexibility to do some of the things you can do with online giving. If you don't have this means, if your furnace blows up on Tuesday and you got to have money, you're going to be cold on Sunday. Most of the world and church world has waited till Sunday and take an offering. You have an immediate need. You send it out, click this button, and meet the need. It's a great process. You also have the ability to structure your appeals. You can manipulate your appeals so that your appeal is palatable to a millennial versus the one going to the senior adults in your congregation. Lots of tools you can do with these things. Sometimes people say, but what about the worshipful act of putting the money in the offering plate? Well, I have a grandson that sits beside me in church a lot, and I want him to see me dropping things in too. So some churches put a little card that says online giving. You pull it out. It does feel weird to watch the offering plate go by and not put something in. For us, we're used to it. Millennials, like, what difference could that possibly make if you put something in the offering plate or not? I'm giving, you know? And it feels like a first fruit kind of giving because they set up recurring giving. Or they get paid every other Friday, they tithe every other Friday. It feels very right to them. It will make your people far more consistent in their giving, especially if you get one that lets you do the recurring gifts. But for those of us, you know, sometimes you can take an offering envelope and just write on, I gave online, let me know if you didn't get it. And drop that in if there's something about the worship of dropping something in a plate that makes that significant for you. Very easy to do these days. You don't want PayPal or something like that that doesn't make it look like you. The banks and the PayPal, they like customers, so they want you. They want their logo places, and they want you to look like them. But you want to get to a secure site where somebody's going to move money without actually looking like you're not on your own website anymore. You want that to be very smooth and fluid in the transition, with lots of flexibility. But your options are pretty much adapt to this, or tell people if you're going to give to our church, you're going to give the way we want to take it, and we like to take checks. That won't be a great message, but you can do that if you want. So our generation wants to give so somebody else can make a difference. The world coming along wants to be the difference makers. They want to have their hands on in that world and actually make the difference. The people like me want to leave a legacy. We're kind of attached to our names on things. If you look around here, you'll see some of the great donors at Mount Vernon that have given names, named gifts so that the building is named after them. And if you go into some of your churches, you'll see little plaques on the end of the windows and the pianos and all that kind of stuff. Don't use that appeal with the millennials. Don't stand in front of your millennials and say, hey, everybody give $100, we're going to put your name on the window. Because that is a turnoff. They're not interested in that kind of personal glory, but our generation is somewhat impressed with that. And that kind of bleeds over into endowments. For our generation, and especially the war generation, but the baby boomers as well, have saved, have worked hard, have built this chunk of stuff. In the foundation, we work with people in their estates, and often we sense a fear for them that when they go to heaven, their kids or their church are going to blow all the money. And that can be fairly legitimate worry. And often we run into people that say, my kids don't need my money. I just want to give it all away. We have an increasing number of people that just say, I want to leave my entire estate to the church. But they don't want their church to just have a party. In fact, they may not trust that their church would be able to handle the money. If you get a windfall, if you're pastoring people that get a windfall, which some of you have in the oil fracking country, you've had people that have went from a certain lifestyle to suddenly there's money for everything. That can be really bad. It can be bad for them spiritually, and they can lose an awful lot. If you win $1 million in the lottery, you're far more likely to go bankrupt in the next 10 years than the average person. And so most people that get a chunk of money get rid of it. They lose it, get rid of it, it's gone pretty quick. The millennials or the baby boomers just don't like that. Don't like the fact that their money may all go away. And while we haven't been a very endowment-oriented church, you're probably beside some Methodist churches and some Presbyterian churches that have large endowments. They're not as worried about cash flow, can sustain themselves through ups and downs because they get large endowments. Church of Nazarene Foundation is the endowment. Has an endowment service for every Nazarene church. And there are gifts that could happen to your local church in endowments that you wouldn't get any other way. You're not going to get the money for spending purposes now, but you could get it if you ask for endowments. And so these folks that are thinking about legacy, the time is ripe to deal with them on legacy gifts, on giving toward the end of their life, on making something useful happen that will outlive them. I can give an example with my dad here. My mom passed away 8 years ago. And my family, with my dad in his grief, said to him, let's establish an endowment in her name at Mount Vernon Nazarene University. She loved this place, which we did. The Virginia Florence Lael Endowment Scholarship right here. My dad has never failed to give thousands of dollars to that. In fact, I delivered a check over here yesterday, a significant check to the endowment fund, because he knows that in some way, my mom's going to have influence past her life. Her name's going to last past that. And while that may not be a tremendous spiritual motivation, it's the way life is, and it's the way the baby boomers are. They want to make a difference for the world out there, have worked hard for this money, don't want this money to be blown, and understand the concept of endowment. When you're working with the senior adults, there are several different kinds of gifts that sometimes we don't know that are available. The foundation, while it has an online will planner and provides language for bequests, also work with charitable trusts, with gift annuities, and with several giving instruments that help people avoid taxes. Sometimes those gifts involve making a gift earlier than death, because you don't need to bypass the your tax benefit is easier early on in life, or could be more beneficial earlier in life than actually waiting until the end. So when you think about legacy giving, if you're thinking about using the foundation for any of these things, recognize that it's not all wait till they die money anymore. It used to all be wait till they die money. But we have dealt with people, million-dollar estates, and they want to leave $200,000 in their will to the church, and we show them that if you give the $200,000 away now into the right kind of giving instruments and the taxes that they would save now and some of the interest that they can get back off the trusts, their kids actually wind up with more than if they wait till the end of their life to give the money away. That's a winner. Everybody wins in that situation. We have great expertise on this and are anxious to share it with anybody. The folks coming along behind us want to leave their mark on the world now, and they are not impressed with this. I would, however, go to the millennials at baby time. When they have babies, they start to get serious about life. And while they wouldn't go out and get a will for any other reason, they do sense the need of getting their will done. It's good stewardship to have your will done. You don't want the state of Ohio figuring out what's going to happen to your kids or where your money's going. But that's a great time for the church to have a will planning party. And the younger people are, when they put the church in their will, the more likely it is to be there when they actually go to heaven. So if you're younger than 43 and you say, I would like to give 10% of my estate to the First Church of the Nazarene, it's more likely to be there when they die than if they put the church in after they're 65. After they're 65, they tend to change it a few times. So will planning definitely works for the younger ones. It's a skeptical generation. They want to see the results of their gift. I think I would tithe if I had a lousy preacher and a dead church, and it was my church, I'd tithe because I'm supposed to. The world coming along behind us is looking at us and saying, why? How? What's the effectiveness? Why would I give any of my money to something unless I can see that it's making a difference in the world? They are a very generous generation, but they care about integrity like lenders care about credit checks. They want to make sure that the money is being used properly, that it's making a difference in the world. And then they connect the volunteerism with the things that they actually do. So whereas I grew up on sermons, a lot of sermons and things like Friend Day and Sunday School contests to bring your neighbors to church and all that kind of stuff. Is anybody else, was that just my experience, or did anybody else know about those? Yeah, you heard about those, right? Friend Day, preach, if you'll just bring somebody, it's right before revival. I want you to go home. Everybody raise your hand if you're going to invite three of your neighbors to come to church. This generation moves through things a little bit different than that. They'll check out the church and see what's going on. And if they like it, they may be willing to actually get involved. And once they're involved and doing things, giving and so forth, they move very easily to advocate. In fact, the millennial generation doesn't need the sermon that we needed, go out and bring your friends to church. If the millennial generation believes that their church is alive, is doing something significant, you can't stop them from bringing their friends. That's the most natural thing that happens to them. They're so social that their whole connection is, oh, I found something good, bring all my friends to it. That's just so natural for them. It works with church as well, if they're absolutely convinced that the church is on target. If they come and say, oh, this church has got a great mission, you know, they're really not accomplishing that mission. They sit around and fight a lot, and they have a lot of arguments and stuff. They run from that. They're not interested in spending any time in that sort of thing. But if they believe that what they're seeing is real, they will move to advocates rather quickly. Some of this is for outside of the church, for donors, but most organizations lose their new people very quickly within the first 18 months. And I think we do in the church too. It's pretty close to that. But the most number one reason is because of indifference. They don't see. They've asked the question why, and they're not getting answers. And so your millennials are going to want to see the answer why. When it comes to their actual giving, it's about the relationship. It's not about the money. And the number one thing you can do to move a non-giving millennial to a giving millennial is to give them a task in the church, because their volunteerism often precedes their financial contribution. They tend to connect their volunteerism to their giving pretty significantly. So go back to that missionary service that comes along. I'm sure lots of people are still having Sunday night missionary services once a month. And so if you're having that missionary service, what we would kind of tend to do is say, okay, here's the book, open up the book, we're going to have the lesson. Oh, we need four people to read scripture. Okay, we'll cut this out of the book and make a little strip. And as people come in through the door, say, hi, I want you to read this. This is about Missionary Joe over here. At one point in the service, I'm going to have you stand up and read about that. So the person stands up and reads about Missionary Joe. We've done this before, right? The millennial crowd likes to volunteer. They like to explore. They like to learn on their own. They would be unimpressed with being asked to volunteer to stand up and read about Missionary Joe on the spot on Sunday night. But if you were going to have a missionary event and you said to them, hey, Mr. Millennial or Miss Millennial, can you see what's going on in Guatemala? I want to talk about missions, and I was just wondering, maybe the Church of the Nazarene has something going on in Guatemala. Obviously, we have something going on in Guatemala. Could you see if you could find a missionary to talk about on Guatemala and tell us about that missionary and what their life is? Now you've just done something for the millennial that they know. Find information, seek information, go out and get information, and come back and report. And that discovery of information is the kind of volunteerism that they like. That's the kind of volunteerism that makes this thing happen. That's connection for them. Now they feel like they're a part of this thing, not because they read something somebody else wrote, but because they went out and sought out information. So I think you can connect a lot of millennials just by having them help do sermon research. You know, say, hey, I heard about this new social media thing called Periscope. Do you know anything about that? Or Snapchat? What do you know anything about that? Can you tell me about that? Get them giving you information in the process, because that volunteerism precedes the gifting. And they'll get on your boat if they believe in what you're doing, but if they see that you're not actually doing it, they get right off. They're also a lot more specific about their giving. They don't give to nearly as many organizations. We tend to give to everybody that knocks on the door, from the Boy Scouts to the local church to this organization and that organization. They have more refined lives. They volunteer in less and they give to less. So the older member guests, I've already told you this one, the more likely they are to keep the church in their will. We have lots of opportunity here for estate gifts, endowments, and non-cash gifts. Right now, if I were seriously trying to raise money in a local church, I would think about the fact that 92% of what the people own that are sitting in my congregation is not in cash. And I would think about the fact that when I go to raise money in the church, I say, please give your cash. So just think about this. 92% of what they own is non-cash, and what we're asking for is from the 8% of what they do own. So I would turn that whole thing around. I'd say, you want to give some stock? What do you do if somebody just said, hey, I'd like to give you some stock. What's your answer to them? Why not? Do it. You put your hand out and say, just put the certificates here. We'll be happy to receive the certificates. We're not really accustomed to this kind of thing. And now, it's not that hard. Actually, it's relatively easy. In fact, the foundation will be happy to receive the funds, either by stock certificate, receive it into from the brokerage. We'll make all the deal with the brokerage. In about a week, you'll have cash. We'll bring it in. We'll sell it and give you the cash back. But especially in times when stocks have inflated like they have recently, that really benefits their gift. Because if you have somebody that's got a couple $100,000 worth of stock and they're giving you $12,000 a year in tithe out of their income, but they've got these stocks that have appreciated, they could give you $12,000 worth of stock every year, bypass all the capital gains on that, and have a significant tax benefit under their in their giving. And if they would like it to be regulated out, we actually have people that give stock to the foundation once a year, and we pay their tithe for them throughout the next year. We send a monthly check for them through a donor advised fund. Gifts of real estate, we handle about one piece of real estate per month. And very seldom do people ask for these things. When it comes to legacy gifts, often people who are really involved in their church will leave something to a hospice or a hospital or a school or something. And when you talk to these people and say, why did you not include your local church in your estate plan? Because that's where you spent all your time. That's where you spent your life. And the answer is typically, the church didn't ask. The hospital asked if we would put them in their estate, or the hospice asked, or the school asked, but the church didn't ask. And so really the Church of the Nazarene Foundation is all about helping you get your people to make gifts to your local church. And the time has never been more ripe to harvest estate gifts from millennial or from the baby boomers. There's wealth out there, and this will have to be a significant part of the church's future. Sometimes I have real fun. I get to call pastors up and say, Mrs. Smith that was in your congregation, we're going to be sending you a check from her estate. She left you a chunk of money. I have never had a pastor that was disappointed by that phone call, ever. In fact, usually the question is, or the response is, wow, this is just in time. You know, weren't praying for her to die, but it was just in time. And there really is a lot of generosity out there. How am I doing here? 8 minutes? Oh, we're doing awesome. We're not really, but we had a sweet old lady, and she said, small church, she knew that her tithe was pretty significant for her church. They were basically living off her tithe, and she said, if I die, they're not going to have my tithe. It's going to be devastating for the church. And so she asked us the question, what would it take, how much money would it take for my church to receive my tithe for at least 20 years after I'm gone? That's a pretty significant tithe. We did the numbers up and said, that'd be $400,000. She said, oh, I would love to do that. Let me write you a check. Gave the $400,000. She's now in heaven. She's been there about 2 years. We continue to send her tithe to her local church. The DS said, that was a major plus in getting a pastor for that church, because you have at least one tither, you know, you're going to be there for the next 18 years. So we can do that kind of stuff. Well, there haven't been any questions, and I've been rambling right along. We said we'd leave a few minutes, so we have about six of them left. We'll talk about funding the mission or any of this you want to.
What's the most effective way that you found to make that ask for legacy giving? Mm-hmm. Is it from the platform? Is it a bulletin? Is it like on a continuous basis? What's the most effective way to make that ask for people to...
Yeah. People, if you do a presentation, presentations are necessary, but the timing is really essential, because most people don't come to a meeting and say, oh yeah, hey, let's all do our estate plans. Some people have already gotten that taken care of, but there's usually a ripe moment, like a sweet spot in somebody's life, and they have to know that you're available when the sweet spot happens. We had a call come in from New Mexico, and the lady said, you were at my assembly, and I just wanted to follow up with you. I'd like to do something with my estate. And she mentioned the individual who had been in their assembly, and said, he hasn't been in your assembly for 5 years. Yeah, it was about 5 years ago. Who's at the assembly? She called, but now the timing was right. You know, it was the right time. But you have to know it's available out there. So you don't want to hammer the church, but little bulletin inserts a couple times a year, a little video. It's kind of fun. Sometimes I show up live on people's things. We do a live video, a live commercial. And if you just up on the screen during the announcement time, hi, Mark Lale, I'm in Kansas City. Listen, here's my phone number. If anybody's thinking about making an estate gift to Beaver Creek, they'd call us and we'd be glad to help assist with that. To do that kind of thing, or show one of the little videos. But it's kind of, I think that the continually putting it out there that this is available. And maybe highlight a different one every once in a while. Probably the best thing out there is when you receive an estate gift to make a big deal out of it and say, Mrs. Smith passed away, she left. If anybody else would like to bless the church, if you'd like for the church to receive something like this, that would be it'd be good.
One question, Mark. You mentioned just real briefly when you're talking about online giving, marketing to different age groups. Mm-hmm. Are you talking about through social media to them? Or are you talking about for the platform? What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't mail a paper letter that's 2 pages long to the millennials. However, that's still effective with the older crowd. You can mail a letter to your older crowd, show up and make a pastoral call a couple weeks later. They remember reading it. They have it still out there. You know, I received this letter from you because that letter is important. I guess, to be honest, Mike, I don't really know what I was thinking of when I said that. But
I think you're right. Generations you were talking about, it would be a different approach. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking in our congregation, they're all there together.
Yeah.
You know, in a service, worship service. I wonder if there's a better way, because we're looking into the online giving thing. Mm-hmm. And the flexibility you're talking about, I just wonder if there's a better way for me to tap the millennials to say to them, hey, you can do this. And like a lot of them are talking about, you know, let's invest in a well in Africa.
Yeah.
So then they all get in and do a well, and they feel good about it because they can Google that place and find out they just put a well in.
And wells are popular these days.
They are.
They really are. That's the number one. I want to do it well.
But the members were like, no, that's not as motivated.
Yeah.
I just thought maybe there might be a segment.
If your church needs new windows, and you stand up there and say, we love this church, this building is important to us, the windows are rotten and old, we got to have some new windows, you'd want to do that to the senior adult class. You know, the younger folks aren't as motivated to the building. They're going to need to see things like, why do we need new windows? You know, so if you're taking money in on Sunday morning, are you telling people right then and there why it's important that they give? That's really important to the young folks. So as you're asking for offering, you say, little Susie, come up here. Little Susie was saved in church this morning. Isn't this great? She's in Sunday school. She gave her heart to Jesus. Can you tell us, do you love Jesus? Yes, you love Jesus. Little Susie, do you know that if you didn't give, little Susie may not know Jesus? It's important that you give because there's other little Susies out there that need to know Jesus. That connects the need. That's hitting them right where it's at. The boomers, you can say, pay your tithe because God said to. And the millennials, you have to show them that something good is happening. Or if somebody wasn't saved, did you help a lady who became a widow this week? And the church provided food and ministered to her. They want to see that kind of thing. They're not opposed to fixing the windows if new windows means people are going to get saved and compassion helps. Folks are helped compassionately. So they're not opposed to that as long as there's a purpose and reason for it. But they don't love the building. Anybody else? In the 2.5 minutes we have left?
When we started doing the kiosk giving online giving, it was that older group who was really pushing us for it. And so if my head, I thought, oh, we'll do it for the millennials, and I had these older ladies and men kind of just...
Yeah, so... Yeah, the kiosks, believe it or not, are kind of going out of style.
Yeah.
with the smartphones, because the kiosk, you still have to stop, you still have to do it, you might have to wait in line, you got to get your purse out and all these different things. When we all have the tools, and even the online, there was a period there when everything was texting. Text your money in, you know, text to give, which was a really expensive way to do it. Often those wound up on your telephone bill. So you could really motivate teenagers to give at an event. But their dads, when they were paying the bill, and they came down and said, what's this $25 on the... Oh, yeah, that was at a concert, and I wanted to give to them. You know, well, that wasn't good. That didn't work out so well when it comes to paying the bill. And that actually is a very expensive way to do it. So text to give has actually converted now. Most anybody that's doing text to give is not really texting to give. They're texting a number... or something really easy to do in, and they're getting an immediate text back, which has a hyperlink just to a giving page. And so it's the giving page, which you could do a lot of different ways. You could put a QR code on your bulletin, or just tell them to do the short, you can do the short mini links like I did with the Bitly link up here earlier. You can do all those kind of things, and even the apps are almost not as necessary because you have to go to download the app, get the app from your church and so forth. Really, the easiest way to do it is to have a simple web page, giving page that works on that will adapt itself to a phone. So if you're on a computer, it's the right size. If you're on a tablet, it's the right size, and it's here. And then use everything else to get to that. And fortunately, that's actually one of the cheapest ways to get it done. So you probably shouldn't be paying for a giving app anymore, and you shouldn't be paying anybody to text to give. All of those technologies are being designed to actually point you to a giving page now, which is mobile friendly. So yeah, things I was saying, I would have said in this webinar or seminar 5 or 6 years ago have changed already. And kiosks were popular for a period of time. I don't know of anybody putting new kiosks in anymore. They've all got a kiosk in their purse or in their pocket. They also data check your sermons now. I teach a Sunday school class, and it's like all I have to do is state one wrong fact everywhere. Like 60 seconds later, everybody's got it figured out that, hey, wait a minute, it wasn't North Dakota, it was South Dakota.